Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, October 10th. I'm Lisa Music reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, a 4-year-old child is missing and her father is in custody, but not talking. Election 2024, the race for California Assembly District 2, and County Conversations, a monthly check-in with Humboldt County's 2nd District Supervisor, Michelle Bushnell. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more, coming right up. The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office is actively searching for 4-year-old Thompson Thompson, who was reported missing under suspicious circumstances. Thompson, who is from Hoopa, was last seen on October 5th during a scheduled visit with her father, Peter Thompson. The father, who does not have custody rights, failed to return her after the visit. Thompson's legal guardian, appointed by the court, reported her missing on October 9th. Law enforcement officials quickly acted, obtaining an arrest warrant for Peter Thompson on child abduction charges on the same day. A Feather Alert was also issued, a notification system that focuses on missing Native American individuals, as Thompson is of Yurok tribal affiliation. On the evening of October 9th, Peter Thompson turned himself in to the Humboldt County Correctional Facility. While in custody, he has refused to share any information about his daughter's whereabouts, further complicating the search efforts. Thompson Thompson is described as 3 feet 7 inches tall, weighing 50 pounds, with brown hair and brown eyes. She was last seen wearing a black floral t-shirt, black pants, and cowboy boots. The sheriff's office is asking for the public's assistance in locating the missing child, as every moment is critical. Anyone with information regarding the whereabouts of Thompson Thompson is urged to contact the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office at 707-445-7251. For a photo of the missing child, please visit kmud.org under our News tab. KMA News continues our conversation series with local officials. Lauren Schmidt sat down with Humboldt County's 2nd District Supervisor, Michelle Bushnell.
In this edition of County Conversations, our monthly check-in with Humboldt County Supervisors, we speak with Michelle Bushnell, who represents Humboldt's 2nd District. This district includes cities and unincorporated towns along the 101 corridor, from Benbow to Fortuna, and stretches east to west from Bridgeville to Shelter Cove. Supervisor Bushnell is actively addressing a range of critical issues affecting her district. But tonight, we're focusing on the current response to fires in homeless camps in southern Humboldt. Good afternoon, Supervisor Bushnell, and thank you for joining us again on KMUD News. As I just mentioned, there have been an increase in calls for service related to a particular homeless camp in Redway. And you recently organized a meeting to address the concerns of residents. Can you share an overview?
Sure. So I did organize the meeting. I had the two fire chiefs from Garberville and Redway, Tim Teets and Seth, Chief Ayers, there, along with Code Enforcement, John Ford, Director Ford, and Dean Beck. And I had DHHS there, Connie Beck, and the sheriff there, as well as myself. And so we started out with a conversation about what's it look like for responses from those two departments? How many times have they went in there? And then kind of diving down into what can we do? So these fires have been prominent on the north end of Redway. In fact, there was one yesterday, a small one yesterday, but this is a private landowner that owns a large section of the upper portion of Redway that has about 5 prominent homeless camps on there that have been there for 20, 30 years, been a long time. And what can we do? How do we control, first of all, the fires, because it's very scary and it has been intensifying with larger fires, and it's an immediate threat to Redway and the Garberville area and with the homeless camps in Garberville. And so we came up with a plan. Code Enforcement went in the day before and surveyed all the camps on the north end and talked with the landowner, and is going to be working with that landowner to see, you know, how he's willing to, you know, clean up, first of all, clean up the camps and to get the people out of there. And that's where DHHS and the sheriff come in. The problem is that those, you know, folks are homeless and they're going to relocate to somewhere else. And so does that mean they're going to relocate on the streets of Redway or the streets of Garberville, or move to a Bear Creek Canyon camp, or, you know, the camps at say on the over by Sproul Creek? And so moving people doesn't fix the problem. It might fix that problem for the north end of Redway and the fires that are happening there, but it's still gonna, there's still the problem out there. So, and it's not easily solved in a one meeting, and folks don't have to be relocated to a service area, which would be Eureka, or try to find housing. It's not against the law to be homeless. So we're still, you know, going to talk about what do we do with these people now. We estimate about 40 people in those camps in the north end of Redway. And so right now the direction is to get them out of there, get all the garbage cleaned up. And we anticipate long-term 6 months for that to happen. We really hope that is attainable within two months.
When we first covered this story, we highlighted the efforts of SHO, the Southern Humboldt Housing Opportunities, to establish a safe camp in Garberville for people experiencing homelessness. These sanctioned encampments provide temporary shelter with fewer barriers to entry, offering a safer and more sanitary environment. Is this something you support? And do you believe this could be a meaningful solution? Or does addressing homelessness in Southern Humboldt require a larger, more comprehensive effort?
Yes, I support a safe camp, but not every homeless person is going to want to be in a safe camp or follow the rules in a safe camp, because you still have to have rules or you get unorderly things happening. And one thing, I mean, it is not a people, whether they're homeless or they're not, there is drug addiction, mental health, and alcoholism that happen with folks. And so you have to have order in a safe camp for it to be valuable and for it to work for the people living there. And so I think that, yes, that'll work for some, but not everybody is going to utilize that. And so it's a bigger picture of what we can do. And, you know, not everybody's going to like the solution. Some people are going to go to jail if that's what they choose, and they choose not to relocate or utilize the system, then, you know, then you're going to get a ride to the jail. And not everybody, you know, likes those options. But at this point, we're having way too much activity in the homeless camps that are affecting the rest of the population in the Southern Humboldt area. And so it really is down to, we have to do something.
In addition to the fire risks at homeless camps, the Humboldt Del Norte unit of CAL FIRE has also seen an increase in calls responding to fires at cannabis farms. Is this another concern you're looking at?
Well, so when you say cannabis farm, are you talking about a legal cannabis farm or an illegal cannabis farm?
There have been fires at both licensed and unlicensed farms. I know on October 2nd, a fire in the Dinsmore area was linked to a cannabis farm, and the cultivation permit for that site has since been tabled. And additionally, our understanding is that one of the various fires on the Wood Ranch also originated on a licensed cannabis farm.
First of all, I'm not aware of any fires on legal farms. So if the farm in Dinsmore is in the process of legalization, that doesn't sound like it's a legal farm. Also on the Woods Ranch, I'm not aware of that there was a cannabis farm up there that had a fire. I am aware of illegal cultivation sites that have had fires in their drying sheds. This happens often when, you know, when you're kind of hiding, and that has happened. So the solution, I think, is, you know, licensed farms are much more restrictive and have guidelines. And that's why you're not seeing fires on licensed farm, because you can't just put a propane tank there and not have it secured, or, you know, for drying, or run a generator without, you know, having it enclosed in a container and so forth and so on. Oftentimes those fires are happening from propane tanks with Mr. Heater heads on them, or generators that are, their exhaust maybe is getting into the, they're hiding that generator. And so the exhaust is heating up maybe grass and it's sparking that way. And so I think, first of all, you know, the licensed farms have strict guidelines, and that has helped a lot, the fire activities with cannabis farms. And then secondly, you know, encouraging folks just by word of mouth to, you know, to be safer. But also, I know the sheriff has been, you know, going out and getting unlicensed farms, and hopefully that will help that situation. And, you know, I just think being the community fire, especially, you know, most fires are started by people. And so being aware that there's a fire risk, the fires in the homeless camps mostly are started by cooking fires, and they get out of control and become larger fires like we've seen in the last month. And so just, you know, education to the homeless, maybe getting them some resources that aren't open fires for cooking, having fire extinguishers in those camps. Also just with the general public, you know, letting people know we're not okay with this behavior. If you're going to dry your weed, you know, don't have an open flame 5 feet away from your weed in a shed that's going to ignite. And because fires vary, you know, we've seen all through California and other states, it devastates. And our resources, which is our volunteer fire departments, are exhausted. It's late in the year. It's October. It was 100 degrees the other day. And, you know, they responded in 3 weeks to 4 fires in Redway. They respond to a large fire on the Woods Ranch. They responded to another fire on the Hanson Ranch. And so resources are really drained. And we as a community just need to say, be aware of your surroundings. Don't create a situation where you're going to start a fire.
Again, that was Supervisor Michelle Bushnell speaking in our monthly check-in, County Conversations. Following our interview, Kama News spoke with a CAL FIRE Del Norte Unit Battalion Chief who confirmed that their agency has been responding to fires at both licensed and unlicensed cannabis farms. The chief urged everyone to use caution, especially with extension cords and fans during harvest season. For more safety tips, you can visit readyforwildfire.org.
Eureka High School was placed on lockdown today after a new threat was reported to school administrators, marking the second security incident in as many days. According to the Eureka Police Department, during the lockdown, there was no evidence of an immediate danger on campus, but the lockdown was initiated as a precautionary measure to ensure the safety of students and staff. EPD officers responded swiftly and secured the campus while investigating the nature and credibility of the threat. During the lockdown, the public was asked to avoid coming to the school to allow law enforcement to focus on their investigation. EPD assured worried parents that the students were safe during the lockdown. The incident follows a similar situation that occurred yesterday, during which a bomb threat led to the evacuation of the school. That situation saw a large response from law enforcement, including a bomb squad, and resulted in one student being detained. After a thorough investigation, the buildings were cleared and no explosives were found. Eureka Police Public Information Officer Laura Montano has reassured the public that today's lockdown is being handled with the same level of caution, and updates will be provided as the situation develops. The police department has advised the community to follow their social media accounts for real-time information. By 2:41 this afternoon, the EPD announced that the lockdown had been lifted, thanking the community for their patience and cooperation. This series of threats has understandably caused concern among parents and community members. KMUD News will continue to monitor this situation as it develops. Reporting for KMUD News, I'm Lisa Music. In election news, KZYX's Elise Cox interviewed the two candidates vying for Jim Wood's assembly seat in November.
California Assembly District 2 stretches from Santa Rosa to Crescent City and includes 5 counties, Del Norte, Humboldt, Mendocino, Trinity, and Sonoma. This week, I sat down with the two candidates who are vying for the seat currently held by Jim Wood. Mike Greer is a Republican from Crescent City, and Chris Rogers is a Democrat from Santa Rosa. Both candidates are dedicated public servants with decades of experience, and both were refreshingly candid about how they would tackle the challenges we face here in Mendocino County and in the larger district. We'll share some selected quotes from those interviews in this newscast. I hope you'll also be persuaded to listen to the entire interviews, which are available on the web at kzux.org and via the new KZYX 2024 Elections Podcast, which is available wherever you get your podcasts. Mike Greer is a former teacher who has done everything from helping build a nuclear power plant to selling insurance. He began his public service career as a city council member in Gridley, California, which is in Butte County, at the age of 27, and he has served in a variety of roles related to education, including as the president of the school board for the Paradise Unified School District during the Camp Fire and as the elected director for Region 1 of the California County Boards of Education representing Lake, Mendocino, Humboldt, and Del Norte. He's also a former president of the California Teachers Association. Greer is running because he says it's time for a change.
I think maybe the main reason that I need to be elected is a simple reason that we have sustained over the last 10 years the same policies, the same problems, and things haven't changed. Our costs have gone up, whether it's the cost of energy, the cost of living, groceries. It's all that's gone up, our insurance. All these different things have happened and nothing has been done. We've been given promises after promises after promises, but nothing has happened. And from someone from Crescent City, we don't have any say-so in rural counties, what really happens. Everything is based on city issues. One size does not fit all.
Greer describes himself as a Republican who can work with Democrats, and he cites his experience at the California Teachers Association as proof of that.
I think because I've worked for so long with CTA as a Republican over the years, that I'm able to get along with other groups of people. And I think we need to do that. We don't see that civil discourse anymore. One of the other things we have in California is we have a one-party government. Because of the supermajority, we need to get rid of that supermajority. And that's another reason I'm running, is to get rid of that.
Like Greer, Rogers also began his career in office when he was 27 and was elected to the Santa Rosa City Council. That was back in 2016. Prior to that, he worked as a staffer for Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey and also for State Senator Mike McGuire.
I've now been on the City Council for 8 years, was mayor for 2 years. And I've been through 4 wildfires, a pandemic, a drought, and a flood with my community. We had a couple of earthquakes as well. It's the free space on our bingo card, living so close to the geysers. But I've not just helped to rebuild our community, but I've also been a regional leader on a number of issues. I was the chair of the Sonoma County Transportation Authority, the Regional Climate Protection Authority. I was the chair of the Mayors and Council Members Legislative Task Force, working on all things that touched local government. Over in Sacramento. I'm on the board of directors for the Sonoma Clean Power. I'm on the board of directors for the Sonoma Marin Area Rail Transit. And not only was I the chair for the California League of Cities Environmental Quality Committee, I also still serve now on the National League of Cities Energy, Environment, and Natural Resources Committee. I've worked in the green energy space and on public policy related to climate for a number of years, and in fact, worked on legislation in 15 states on renewable energy. And I've been really proud in this campaign to be able to focus on the things that matter the most to the North Coast, things such as housing availability and costs, things like insurance, things like the impacts of climate change, transportation, rural healthcare. These are all issues that I have a background with. But I decided to step up and run for the state assembly because I felt like we needed local voices who understood public policy and understood the impact on our local communities who understand that a one-size-fits-all approach to public policy doesn't work.
Rogers offered specific plans for addressing everything from the shortage of affordable housing to the high cost of energy via continued investment in renewables, but also in increased accountability and approaches such as municipal-owned utilities and community choice aggregators.
The most expensive of the municipal utilities is cheaper than the least expensive investor-owned utility, because rather than paying a profit to shareholders, these municipal utilities instead are able to invest back in their communities and lower costs and make those infrastructure investments. That's one model that I'm very supportive of. The other is community choice aggregators, your CCAs. So Sonoma Clean Power, which I'm on the board of directors for, covers both Sonoma and Mendocino counties. It is already cheaper than PG&E to deliver energy.
You can listen to the entire interview at kzyx.org. I'm Elise Cox.
In state news, UC Healthcare service workers rally statewide for higher wages, housing amid contract impasse. Pacifica Radio's Teresa Wierzbianska brings you the details.
Members of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 3299, which represents thousands of healthcare and service workers at UC campuses, are demanding higher wages and improved working conditions. The union held noontime rallies at UC medical centers from Davis to San Diego to protest an impasse in contract negotiations. Natisha Booker is a senior custodian at UC Davis Medical Center.
We're tired. We're sick and tired of UC second-class treatment to us. We are not going to stop fighting until we win!
The university system and the union have been in contract negotiations for around a year. The union says the real wages of frontline UC patient care technicians and service workers has declined around 8% under the weight of inflation since 2017, and staff vacancies have tripled since the pandemic, creating overwork and shortfalls in service. Housing costs in California regions with UC campuses and medical centers like San Francisco or Los Angeles are roughly 45% more expensive than the national average. The union says that cost has pushed healthcare and service workers to move farther away from centers, forcing them to sleep in their cars between daily shifts or apply to wait lists for government-subsidized housing. Fabricio Sasso is the executive director of the Sacramento Central Labor Council.
You did your jobs, you did it really well, you were professionals, and they're not recognizing that, and that's a slap in the face.
Yeah!
That's a slap in the face to all of you who works too damn hard to put food on the table and pay your mortgage and pay your rents and make it month to month without a whole lot to live on afterwards. You all deserve better.
Yeah.
And they should know it.
Yeah.
They need to know it.
UC is the state's third largest employer and its single largest landlord. The union charges the university system with prioritizing administrator salaries over living wages. They say UC recently granted 30% pay raises to its highest paid chancellors, who now earn between $800,000 and $1.2 million per year and receive generous UC housing subsidies, while frontline workers receive little to no housing aid. The university system said in a statement that it had been bargaining in good faith with the union and presenting meaningful proposals to directly address the union's requests, including wage increases that, if accepted, would increase AFSCME salaries by 26% over the life of the five-year contract. The union says the offer is insufficient. Now that the mediation meetings have concluded without satisfactory result, UC and AFSCME will move to the next step in the impasse process called fact-finding, in which a neutral third party will meet with the two sides to negotiate a final labor contract. I'm Teresa Wierzbianska, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
In national news, Supreme Court weighs blocking Biden administration rule on untraceable ghost guns made from kits, challenged by gun owners and manufacturers in Texas. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The nation's main gun control law, the Gun Control Act of 1968, requires gun makers and dealers to have federal license, keep records of gun sales, and conduct background checks. But recent years have seen the spread of ghost guns with no serial numbers that can be easily made at home from a kit. The Biden administration's Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, or ATF, issued a rule in 2022 to classify ghost guns as firearms. But a district court in Texas blocked the rule, an appeals court agreed, and the Supreme Court took up the case of Garland v. Vanderstock. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar argued the case for the Biden administration.
This court should make clear that the act regulates these products as what they are, firearms and frames and receivers of firearms.
She says the rule is in keeping with 50 years of regulations that look at how easy it is to end up with a firearm.
They've advertised the products, in their words, as ridiculously easy to assemble and dummy-proof, and touted that you can go from opening the mail to have a fully functional gun in as little as 15 minutes. No serial number, background check, or records required. Those untraceable guns are attractive to people who can't lawfully purchase them or who plan to use them in crimes.
According to the ATF, ghost guns have become increasingly popular in crimes, including 1,200 homicides and attempted homicides from 2016 to 2022. Prelogar says blocking the new regulation would have far-reaching effects on how the whole Gun Control Act is interpreted.
At that point, it can't serve out its function because all manufacturers everywhere could simply exempt their products from regulation through that simple expedient. And that means that going forward, all guns could become ghost guns.
Opponents of the new rule were represented by lawyer Peter Patterson.
Congress in the Gun Control Act did not seek to pursue its purposes of controlling access to firearms to the nth degree.
He disputed how easy it is to make ghost guns, and he challenged the ATF's authority to issue the new rule.
ATF has now exceeded its authority by operating outside of the bounds set by Congress.
Chief Justice John Roberts asked Patterson the purpose of selling kits that, for example, are lacking just a few drill holes to complete. Patterson answered with an analogy.
Well, some individuals enjoy working on their car every weekend, some individuals want to construct their own firearm. So the purpose of selling is to assist and provide individuals with material with which they can do that.
Well, I mean, drilling a hole or two, I would think, doesn't give the same sort of reward that you get from working on your car on the weekends.
Justice Samuel Alito was more sympathetic to the challengers. He questioned Solicitor General Prelogar about the ghost gun kits, using a different analogy.
There. If I show you, I put out on a counter some eggs, some chopped up ham, some chopped up pepper and onions. Is that a Western omelet?
No, because again, those items have well-known other uses to become something other than an omelet. The key difference here is that these weapon parts kits are designed and intended to be used as instruments of combat, and they have no other conceivable use.
Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson raised a different concern, namely the court taking over power that Congress intended for the regulating agency.
I mean, are we to conclude that an agency exceeds its statutory authority whenever it fails to choose what we think is the best meaning of a statutory term? Is that how the scope of the agency's authority to promulgate a rule is supposed to be determined? We just compare what the agency believes qualifies as a firearm with what we think qualifies as a firearm. And if the agency has something in its definition that we wouldn't have put there, we say the agency has exceeded its authority.
How the Supreme Court answers that question and other questions about the rule will be decided in the next few months. The current Supreme Court, with a 6-3 conservative majority, has been skeptical of gun control laws, most recently striking down a ban on bump stocks. But based on the questioning in court, it looks like Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett are likely to join the three more liberal justices in upholding the administration's ghost gun rule. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Tinkler, and thanks to our reporters, Elise Cox, Christopher Martinez, Teresa Wersbianska, and Lauren Schmidt. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see related stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.